Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And as we kind of close out the content part of the week, we're still going through Madison's notes, and we're actually diving into the militia. Now, to be clear, the militia is an integral part of our government. So when we look at the expanse of the United States, every state that was added to the Union was formed by the counties. This is how important counties are. They are the parents to your state. Even though the original 13 states were created by the king, and even though they kind of jumped, you know, ship, and they didn't go through the reforming properly because the cabals were in power. What should have really happened is the people really should have instituted their county governments and then instituted this new sovereign state instead of moving from the king's colony into a sovereign state. If you start understanding exactly what I'm saying, in other words, they allowed some of the bad paradigms to persist in these states. And so getting things right is important. I get dragged into conversations all the time that just is, it's just a waste of my time. I want people, and to be honest with you, when I am all by myself and I'm not trying to help somebody understand what we need to be doing, then I might look at things that are different, but nine times out of ten, there's still a lot of discovery just by going through these notes. I still have to go back through the ratification debates because we're going to be hitting those soon, probably next week. So when I hit the ratification debates next week, we're going to be bringing out content and topics that have never been brought out. So we're going to be adding a new level of highlights. In other words, even though I have the ratification debates that are posted are already heavily highlighted, we're going to, you know, basically go and add new insights, especially with some of these new topics that do need to be expounded upon. Let me ask you now, what topics do you want a better understanding, a framer's context, out of the ratification debates? Because I'll try to pull those things in if it's something that we don't already cover. So, getting back to Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, remember, you know, I'm inviting your feedback on what you'd like for us to bring up in the ratification debates. Now, we'll get Paul back a little bit later when we cover the ratification, the standards, but some of this new stuff, because Paul is not going to be available to contribute due to his schedule and some of the things he's doing, and hopefully he's going to be running for office, and we're, you know, doing something like that. It's, you know, it's a big commitment, and doing this in addition to running, it's tough. And hopefully we'll have Mike Lacoste in Iowa, Bremer County, Iowa, running, and hopefully we'll have other people challenging county commissioners. Folks, that's where your problem really lies right now. You need to get your county commissioners either on board or replace them. Get rid of them quickly. We don't have a lot of time. Now or never. Remember that. Now, Mr. Pinckney, we're still on the 23rd of August. Mr. Pinckney urged the necessity of preserving foreign ministers and other officers of the U.S. independent of external influence and moved to insert after Article 7, Section 7. Now, remember, these are all the old articles that they came up with, the original draft that had like 20-some-odd articles. Quote, no person holding any office of profit or trust under the United States without the consent of the legislature, except of any present emolument officer title of any kind whatever from a king, prince, or foreign state which passed no contest. So, in other words, the nobility clause was actually injected at this point by adding this one thing, urged and moved to insert. So that's what he did. And it passed with no contest. So in other words, that was actually added. Mr. Rutledge moved to amend Article 8 to read as follows. This Constitution, this is Article 8 now, technically it ends up in Article 6. This Constitution and the laws of the United States made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law. Now, they already had done that. In other words, treaties could only be made by the federal government of those things that had been delegated to it. States, based on the Constitution, states cannot enter into treaties. So, in other words, the only treaties that can actually be made with these states and the United States are those treaties that are within the enumerated powers of the Constitution. They can't just go and say, hey, we'd like to actually, you know, take control of health care, so we're going to create a treaty and subjugate us to this law of a foreign nation or this foreign polity so that we can now mandate this health care upon you. They can't do it, folks. That's not enumerated. That's why it says all treaties made under the authority of the United States. Okay? That was the beginning of it. All the treaties made and should be, or all treaties made, well, actually, should I just pull up the color-coded Constitution and dive into Article 6, which actually gives us this actual clause. And it says, the Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States. So in other words, whether they make the treaty or whether they're in the process of making it and or making it, it must be under the authority of the United States. And that's when it shall be the supreme law. If it is not under the authority of the United States, so all these treaties with the World Health Organization, every state can reject any form of law coming from the UN and the World Health Organization or any of these other polities that the United States thought that they could do an end run around our Constitution and create these treaties. Do you understand what I'm saying? Go read the second petition. We clarify this completely. This was actually clarified in the ratification debates. Read petition 2. Anyway, as we move forward, Governor Morris basically says, and Mr. Governor Morris of Pennsylvania, argued against the appointment of officers by the Senate. He considered the body, so we're back onto the militia, he considered the body as too numerous for the purpose as subject to cabal. And as devoid of responsibility, if judges were to be tried by the Senate, according to the late report of the committee, it was particularly wrong to let the Senate have the filling of the vacancies which its own decrees were to create. In other words, he said that this would really create a cabal if you gave the Senate the ability to seat judges and you gave the Senate the ability to remove judges. They could literally start stacking the deck and or stacking the court. Mr. Wilson was of the same opinion for the like reasons. The Article 9 being waived and Article 7, Section 1, resumed. Mr. Governor Morris moved to strike the following words of the 18th clause, quote, enforce treaties, close quote, as to be superfluous since treaties were to be laws, which was agreed not, you know, so in other words, they were just getting rid of these things so that they didn't have to actually say that. It's like when you look at many of the amendments after the 12th Amendment, it's, you know, you'll start finding, oh, well, Congress shall have the authority to execute these laws or to make, you know, to enforce this by legislation. It's almost, I mean, it's redundant, just like what Mr. Governor Morris is saying. It is completely redundant to basically say we're going to make laws to enforce this. Mr. Governor Morris moved to alter the first part of the 18th Clause, Section 1, to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. To alter that. So as to read, to provide for calling forth the militia, which was agreed to no contest. So in other words, he injected the to provide for the calling forth of the militia and to this first part, but basically was saying to execute the laws of the Union and so forth. So anyway, that was all agreed to, no contest. On the question, then agreed to the 18th Clause, Article 1, Section 7, as amended, it is passed in the affirmative, no contradiction. Anyway, Mr. Pinckney, not General Pinckney, moved to add as an additional power to be vested in the legislature of the United States, quote, to negative all laws passed by the states interfering in the opinion of the legislature with the general interest and the harmony of the Union, provided that two-thirds of the members of each House assent to the same. This principle, he observed, had formerly been agreed to. He considered the precaution as essentially necessary. The objection drawn from the predominance of the large states had been removed by the equality established in the Senate. Mr. Broome seconded the proposition. Mr. Sherman thought it unnecessary. The laws of the general government being supreme and paramount to the states' laws according to the plan as it now stands. Mr. Madison proposed that it should be committed. He had been from the beginning a friend to the principle, but thought the modification might be made better. Mr. Mason wished to know how the power, now Mr. Mason, the sage, stands up and says, I'd like to know how the power was to be exercised. Are all laws which are to be brought up, is no road nor bridge to be established without the sanction of the general legislature? Is this to sit constantly in the order to receive and revise the state laws? He did not mean by these remarks to condemn the expedient, but he was apprehensive that great objections would lie against it. Mr. Williamson thought it unnecessary, and having been already declared, a revival of the question was a waste of time. Ah, Mr. Wilson considered this as the keystone, wanted to complete the wide arch of government. We are raising the power of self-defense, had been urged as necessary for the state governments. It was equally necessary for the general government. The firmness of judges is not of itself sufficient. Something further is requisite. It would be better to prevent the passage of improper laws than declare it void when passed. Mr. Rutledge, if nothing else, this alone would damn and ought to damn the Constitution. Will any state ever agree to be bound hand and foot in this manner? It is worse than making mere corporations of them whose bylaws would be subject to this shackle. Mr. Ellsworth observed that the power contended for would rather either that all laws of the state legislature should be previously to their taking effect be transmitted to the general legislature or be repealable by the latter, or that the state executive should be appointed by the general government and have a control over the state laws. If the last was mediated, let it be declared. Now, let me stop right here. They're really pushing and pushing, and we're seeing this over. It was already brought up by who it was. Why are we wasting our time with this? Person that stated that. That's the reality. Even though we see these people trying to push, and I think this is the politics that happens. And this is when we look at these debates, because I kind of was making this comment as we were ending yesterday, that even though you see a lot of arguments supporting some paradigm, some idea. Let's, you know, like this idea of the federal government having the ability to basically negate laws that it considered, you know, bad for the union. Here's the reality. There was a lot of talk about this and a lot of promotion of this, and there was some pushback. The reality is it never made it into the Constitution. So why so much hoopla in the notes? And I believe this is what happens. You get a team of people that say, hey, we're going to push this point, and I'm going to argue, you argue, and we'll just keep pushing and pushing to see if we can break down the resistance of those people who prevailed the last time and see if we can actually get this passed. These people were actually trying to create a centralized government, these few people that were a part of the Constitutional Convention. They felt that having a centralized government and really basically converting states into administrative functions of the general government, that was Madison's original plan. But that was not what the final product was. And there were still men that were still pursuing this. And as a matter of fact, Madison even piped up, you know, just previously in this exact same thing, as we kind of look at what he said here, Madison basically says this, proposed that it should be committed. He had been from beginning a friend to the principle, but thought the modification might make it better. So anyway, my point is this, is that what they were doing was they were trying to push this down. Committed means just put it to the side. Let's just wait and let's see if something else comes along that makes it better. He was not in favor of actually getting it to pass. Mr. Ellsworth observed that the power contended for would require either that the laws of the state legislatures should previously to their taking effect of the administration transmitted to the general. Oh, actually, I just read this. Mr. Pinckney declared that he thought the state executives ought to be so appointed with such control and that it would be so provided if another convention should take place. Mr. Governor Morris did not see the utility or the practicability of the proposition of Mr. Pinckney, but wished it to be referred to the consideration of a committee. Mr. Langdon was in favor of the proposition. He considered it as resolvable into the question whether the extent of the national constitution was to be judged by the general government or the state government. So on the question, it passed negative. In other words, it didn't pass. In other words, all this talk, and let's go through the count. New Hampshire, yes. Massachusetts, no. Connecticut, no. New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania, yes. Delaware, yes. Maryland, yes. Virginia, yes. That was 5. And then no, no, and no. So it was 6-5. All 11 states. Now, just remember, New York had no voice in this because the two anti-federalists, what was it? Not Yates. It was Langston and actually, I've got it right here. So let me just tell you. The two men that never came back that were part of New York was, yeah, Lansing and Yates, Robert Yates. Now, I think Yates was a part of, yes, Yates was a part of the Federalist Papers. He wrote, was it Federalist Paper 2? The only thing he did in the Federalist Papers. And then he kind of backed away from it. Anyway, but he did not sign the Hamilton did sign, but those two men did not. They were not in favor of the Constitution moving forward. Now, as we go down a little bit further, they bring up the subject again of the importation of slaves. And this is on August 25th, a couple of days later. So Mr. Pinckney moved to strike out the words, the year 1800 as the year limiting the importation of slaves, and insert the words 1808. Mr. Gorham seconded it. This is when Madison, as a matter of fact, some people referenced Madison as being very animated. Now, when he wrote his notes later on that night, he didn't speak of his animation. But it was something, if I remember correctly, I remember somebody recounting that Madison kind of jumped up and said, who's going to remember in 20 years that that thing exists in the Constitution? Pointing out the fact that the ending of the slave trade in 1808 would be 20 years later, and basically it would be a bygone, and who would remember to go and say, hey, we're supposed to do this? Remember, Madison was the one that made this the most contentious, and this is what he said. 20 years will produce all the mischief that can be apprehended from the liberty to import slaves. So long a term will be more dishonorable to the national character than to say nothing about it in the Constitution. On the motion which passed in the affirmative, in other words, all of these states now are placating, because New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Connecticut were all yes. New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware, no. Maryland, yes. Virginia, no. And then North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. So it was 7-4. So it passed to 1808. And Madison was not happy. And did he actually stop there? No. But there's a few other people that make comment. Governor Morris was for making the clause read at once, quote, importation of slaves into North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia shall not be prohibited, etc., close quote. This, he said, would be most fair and would avoid the ambiguity by which, under the power with regard to naturalization, the liberty reserved to the states might be defeated. He wished it to be known also that this part of the Constitution was a compliance to those states. If the change of the language, however, should be objected to by the members from those states, he should not urge it. Mr. Mason, or Colonel Mason, stated this. He was not against arguing the term slaves, but against naming North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, lest it should give offense to the people of those states. You know, this is all political correctness. It was alive and well back in those days, right? Mr. Sherman liked a description better than the terms proposed, which had been declined by the old Congress and were not pleasing to some people. Mr. Clymer of Pennsylvania concurred with Mr. Sherman. Mr. Williamson said that both in opinion and practice he was against slavery, but thought it more in favor of humanity from a view of all circumstances to let South Carolina and Georgia on those terms than to exclude them from the Union. Mr. Governor Morris withdrew his motion. Mr. Dickinson wished the clause to be confined to the states which had not themselves prohibited the importation of slaves, and for that purpose moved to amend the clause to read as, quote, the importation of slaves into such of states as shall permit the same shall not be prohibited by the legislature of the United States until the year 1808, which was disagreed to without contest. The first part of the report was then agreed to and amended as follows. The migration or importation of such persons as the several states now existing shall think proper to admit. Boy, this is political correctness gone awry. Shall think proper to admit shall not be prohibited by the legislature prior to the year 1808. Now, this is where New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Maryland, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia said yes, and four states said no, Virginia being one of them. Mr. Baldwin then stated, in order to restrain and more explicitly define, quote, the average duty, close quote, moved to strike out the second part of the words average of the duties laid on imports and insert, quote, common imposts on articles not enumerated, which was agreed to no contest. Mr. Sherman was against the second part, and we're into a break. And so we're going to be right back with this little dialogue as they talked about the importation of slaves and now imposts and so forth. And I believe they get to some imposts on slavery, but we'll see. Anyway, we'll be right back after this important promo. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so now we are talking about Mr. Baldwin, and he wanted to remove the average duty and the common impost on articles not enumerated, which was agreed to. Mr. Sherman was against the second part, as acknowledging men to be property by taxing them as such under the character of slaves. Mr. King and Mr. Langdon considered this as the price of the first part. So now they basically said, hey, we're giving you these things. You got to give us this. In other words, this was really, you know, a throw and a contest of wills regarding the importation tax of slaves, which actually I think it was $10. General Pinckney admitted to it was so. Colonel Mason, no, not to tax will be equivalent to a bounty on the importation of slaves. In other words, if they didn't tax it, then it basically would be open season. Mr. Gorham thought Mr. Sherman should consider the duty not as implying that slaves are property, but as a discouragement to the importation of them. Mr. Governor Morris remarked that as the clause now stands, it implies that the legislature may tax freemen imported. Now, that's kind of a 180 out, right? Anyway, Mr. Sherman answered to Mr. Gorham, observed that the smallness of the duty shewed revenue to be the object, not the discouragement of importation. Now, this is what Mr. Madison states. He thought it wrong to admit in the Constitution the idea that there could be property in men. The reason of duties is not to hold as slaves are to be like merchandise consumed and etc. Now, so he wanted to make sure that they tried to alleviate that. He didn't want the Constitution to be condoning that, which is why they went down the political. And I guess this was one of the few times, if you said, hey, GR, Mr. Madison never really defended the creature, his creature. This might be one of those where he's actually doing that because he's, like he says, he thought it wrong to admit in the Constitution the idea that there could be property in men. Colonel Mason, in answer to Mr. Governor Morris, the provision as it stands was necessary for the case of convicts in order to prevent the introduction of them. It was finally agreed to no contest to make the clause read, quote, but a tax duty may be imposed on such importation not exceeding $10 for each person. And then the second part as amended was agreed to. And then Article 6 was postponed on the motion of Mr. Madison, seconded by Mr. Governor Morris, and then they dove down into the next article, and that closes that little, I'll just say, that slew of debates. And so As we move down a few days, we're going down to Wednesday, August 29th. The property and slaves issue comes up again. How ironic, right? I mean, you know, is this not to be, you know, like they actually resolved this moral issue? Anyway, Mr. Governor Morris opposed the object of the motion as highly injurious. Actually, let me go up to where the motion occurred. Mr. Martin seconded the motion. It was Mr. Pinckney. So let's start there with this motion. And that way we can actually get into Mr. Morris's, you know, insult. Mr. Pinckney moved to postpone the report in favor of the following proposition. Quote, that no act of the legislature for the purpose of regulating the commerce of the United States with foreign powers or among the several states shall be passed without the assent of 2/3 of the members of each house. He remarked that there were 5 distinct commercial interests. 1, fisheries with and with India trade, the trade of India. He remarked that there were 5 distinct, with the trade of India and North England. 2, the interest of New York in a free trade. 3, wheat and flour, the staples of the 2 middle states, New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And 4, tobacco, the staple of Maryland, Virginia, and partly North Carolina. And 5, rice and indigo, the staples of South Carolina and Georgia. These different interests would be a source of oppressive regulations if no check to bear a majority should be provided. States pursue their interest and less scruple than individuals. The power of regulating commerce was a pure concession of the part of the southern states. They did not need the protection of the northern states at present. Mr. Martin seconded the motion. General Pinckney said it was the true interest of the southern states to have no regulation of commerce, but considering the loss brought on the commerce of the eastern states by the revolution, their liberal conduct towards the views of South Carolina and the interests the weak south and the interest the weak southern states had in being united with the strong eastern states. I mean, he's being very sarcastic here. He thought it proper that no fetters should be imposed on the power of making commercial regulations. Now, I'm going to basically highlight that. He thought it proper that no fetters should be imposed on the power of making commercial regulations, and that the constituents, through prejudice against eastern states, would be reconciled to this liberality. He had himself, he said, prejudices against the eastern states before he came here, but would acknowledge that he had found them as liberal and candid as any man whatever. Anyway, Mr. Clymer of Pennsylvania said, the diversity of commercial interest of necessity creates difficulties, which ought to be increased by unnecessary restrictions. The northern and middle states will be ruined if not enabled to defend themselves against foreign regulations. And so it really, they're laying out why the federal government has the responsibility of regulating foreign commerce, but not commerce within the states. That they are to regulate commerce among the states. In other words, playing traffic cop, allowing them to do, and that kind of created this misinterpretation down the road to start creating exportations that are actually targeted imposts that would hurt a very specific sector. Anyway, Mr. Sherman, alluding to Mr. Pinckney's enumeration of particular interest as requiring a security against abuse of the power, observed that the diversity of which itself a security, adding that to require more than a majority to decide a question was always embarrassing, as to had been experienced in cases requiring the votes of 9 states in Congress. Mr. Pinckney replied that his enumeration meant 5-minute interest. It still left the two great divisions of the northern and southern interests. Now, here's really comes to the issue, the property of slaves, because this is a continuance. This is how it builds into this. Mr. Governor Morris opposed to the object of the motion as highly injurious. Preference to American ships will multiply them till they can carry the southern produce cheaper than it is now carried. A navy was essential to security, particularly to the southern states, and can only be had by a Navigation Act encouraging American bottoms and seamen, in other words, American ships and seamen. In those points of view, then, alone, it is the interest of southern states that Navigation Acts should be facilitated. Shipping, he said, was worst and most precarious kind of property and stood in the need of public patronage. Mr. Williamson was in favor of making 2/3 instead of a majority requisite as more satisfactory to the southern people. No useful measure, he believed, had ever been lost in Congress for a want of 9 votes. As to the weakness of the southern states, he was not alarmed on that account. The sickliness of their climate for invaders would prevent their being made an object. He acknowledged that he did not think the motion requiring 2/3 necessary in itself, because if a majority of northern states could push their regulations too far, the southern states would build ships for themselves, but he knew the southern people were apprehensive on this subject and would be pleased with the precaution. Mr. Spate of North Carolina was against the motion. The southern states could at any time save themselves from oppression by building ships for their own use. Mr. Butler differed. He's from South Carolina, differed from those who consider the rejection of the motion as no concession on the part of the southern states. He considered the interest. Now, see, why 2/3? If you really look at how it breaks down, one side of the northern states could not get something passed without the southern states. If it was just a majority, they might actually make it easier to get something passed. Something bad passed. Having a 2/3 majority on almost all bills instead of a democracy in the state legislature and in the national legislature would always be better, wouldn't it? Because it would make it harder for them to create laws. Anyway, being notwithstanding desirous of conciliating the affections of the East states, he should vote against requiring 2/3 instead of a majority. Colonel Mason, if the government is to be lasting, it must be founded on the confidence and affections of the people. He's making a very good point again. And must be so constructed as to obtain these. The majority will be governed by their interests. The southern states are the minority in both states. It is to be expected that they will deliver themselves bound hand and foot to the eastern states to enable them to exclaim in the words of Cromwell on a certain occasion, quote, "The Lord hath delivered them into our hands," close quote. Mr. Wilson took notice of the several objects and remarked that if every peculiar interest was to be secured, unanimity ought to be required. The majority, he said, would be no more governed by interest than the minority. It was surely better to let latter be bound hand and foot than the former. Great inconveniences had, he contended, been experienced in Congress from the Article of Confederation requiring 9 votes in certain cases. Now, Mr. Madison kind of opines a little bit here and says, I went into a pretty full view of the subject. I observed that, because he says he observed, that the disadvantage of the southern states from the Navigation Act lay chiefly in a temporary rise of freight attended, however, with an increase of southern as well as northern shipping with the immigration of northern seamen and merchants to the southern states with a removal of the existing injurious relations among the states on each other. the power of foreign nations to obstruct our retaliating measures on them by a corrupt influence would also be less if a majority should be made competent than if two-thirds of each house should be required to legislative acts in this case. An abuse of power would be qualified with all of these good effects, but he thought an abuse was rendered improbable by the provision of two branches by the independence of the Senate and by the negative of the executive by the interest of Connecticut and New Jersey, which were agricultural, not commercial states. But the interior interest, which was also agricultural in most commercial states, by the accession of the western states, which would be altogether agricultural, he added that the southern states would derive an essential advantage in the general security afforded by the increase of our maritime strength. He stated the vulnerability situation of them and of the Virginia in particular, the increase of the coasting trade, or this trade that's going up and down the coast, and of seamen would be so favorable to the southern states by increasing the consumption of their produce, if the wealth of the eastern should be still greater proportion be augmented, that wealth would contribute the more to the public wants and otherwise a national benefit. Mr. Rutledge was against the motion of his colleague. It did not follow from a grant of power to regulate trade that it would be abused. At the worst of navigation, a Navigation Act could bear hard a little while on the southern states as to laying the foundation for a great empire. We ought to take a permanent view of the subject and not look at the present moment only. He reminded the House of the necessity of securing the West India trade to this country. That was the great object, and the Navigation Act was necessary for obtaining it. Mr. Randolph said that there were features so odious in the Constitution as it now stands that he doubted whether he should be able to agree to it. A rejection of the motion would complete the deformity of the system. He took notice of the argument in favor of giving the power over trade to a majority drawn from the opportunity of foreign powers would have obstructing retaliating measures if two-thirds were made requisite. He did not think that there was weight in that consideration. The difference between a majority and two-thirds did not afford room for such an opportunity. Foreign influence would also be more likely to be exerted on the president, who would require three-fourths by his negative. He did not mean, however, to enter into the merits. What he had in view was merely to pave a way for a declaration which he might be hereafter obliged to make if an accumulation of obnoxious ingredients should not take place, that he could give his assent to the plan. Now, Mr. Gorm, so this is the last comment, and then they get into the vote on the move. Whose was this again? I want to say it was Mr. Pinckney of South Carolina. So now Mr. Gorm says this: if the government is to be so fettered as to be unable to relieve the eastern states, what motive can they have to join in it and thereby tie their own hands for measure which they could be otherwise take for themselves? The eastern states were not to be led to strengthen the Union by fear of their own safety. He depreciated consequence of disunion. But if it should take place, it was the southern part of the continent that had the most reason to dread them. He urged the improbability of a combination against the interest of the southern states, the different situations of the northern and middle states being a security against it. It would moreover certain that foreign ships would never be altogether excluded, especially those of nations in treaty with us. On the question to postpone in order to take up Mr. Pinckney's motion, New Hampshire, no. Massachusetts, no. Connecticut, no. New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania, no. Delaware, no. There you have six states. Boom, boom, boom. All the northern states. No. Now you had Maryland, yes. Virginia, yes. And you had North Carolina, yes. South Carolina, no. And Georgia, yes. So you had 4-7. And there you have it. I mean, when you really look at the two-thirds requirement, right, that's 66%. And when you go to three-fifths, that's 60%. Anyway, the report of the committee for striking out Section 6 requiring two-thirds of each house to pass a Navigation Act was then agreed to without contest. Now, Mr. Butler moved to insert after Article 15, quote, if any person bound to service or labor in any state of the United States shall escape into another state, he or she shall be discharged from such service or labor in consequence of any regulations subsisting in the state to which they escape, but shall be delivered up to the person justly claiming their service or labor. And that was agreed to without contest. Now, Mr. Butler of South Carolina was basically pursuing the, you know, seeking or chasing their property as it ran away from them. How can that be your property if it runs away from you? Now, this goes into the exact next topic that is of high interest, which is the admission of states. Mr. Governor Morris moved to strike out the last two sentences to wit, quote, if the admission be consented to, the new states shall be admitted on the same terms with the original states, but the legislature may make conditions with the new states concerning the public debt which shall be subsisting, close quote. He did not wish to bind down the legislature to admit Western states on the terms here stated. Mr. Madison opposed the motion, insisting that the Western states neither would or ought to submit to a union which degraded them from an equal rank with other states. Colonel Mason stated, and, you know, Madison, obviously I don't think he was trying to defend. I think that he was making a very good salient point. Colonel Mason, if it were possible by any just means to prevent immigrations to the Western country, it might be a good policy, but the people will as they find it in their interest, and the best policy is to treat them with that equality which will make them friends, not enemies. So now you've got Mason basically saying the exact same thing, that they're to be, you know, they're to come into the Union on equal status. Governor Morris did not mean to discourage the growth of the Western country. He knew that to be impossible. He did not wish to throw the power into their hands. Mr. Sherman was against the motion for fixing an equality of privileges by the Constitution. So again, Mr. Morris was basically, you know, being countered by Madison, Mason, and now Sherman. Mr. Langdon was in favor of the motion. He did not know but circumstances might arise which could render it inconvenient to admit new states on terms of equality. Okay, Mr. Williamson was for leaving the legislature free. The existing small states enjoy an equality now, and for that reason are admitted to it in the Senate. This reason is not applicable to the Western states. On Governor Morris's motion to strike it out, New Hampshire, yes. Massachusetts, yes. Connecticut, yes. New Jersey, yes. Pennsylvania, yes. Delaware, yes. Now, Maryland, no. Virginia, no. North Carolina, yes. South Carolina, yes. And Georgia, yes. So the move to strike out for Article 17, but to such admission to the consent of two-thirds of the members present shall be necessary, close quote, before any question was taken out on this motion. Mr. Governor Morris moved, and actually, if you look at the Constitution now, it doesn't require two-thirds. It only requires a majority, and they come in with equal footing. So the cooler, I just say, cooler heads prevailed in being able to make the right decisions as the Constitution was going into its final form. Mr. Governor Morris moved the following proposition or substitute for Article 7. Quote, new states, and now this is actually Article 4, Section 3, new states may be admitted by the legislature into this union, but no new state shall be erected within the limits of any of the present states without the consent of the legislature of such state as well as the general legislature. The first part of this union inclusive was agreed to, no contest. Now, Mr. Martin opposed the latter part. Nothing, he said, was so alarmed to the alarm the limited states as to make the consent of the large states claiming the western lands necessary to the establishment of new states within their limits. So in other words, you got to remember, we talked about this, how the Virginia, the Carolinas, and I think Pennsylvania actually had lands to the west of them, which was the Ohio Valley. As the colonies were kind of being created, they created this perpetual form that went horizontally across the United States from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean, along the latitudes of their boundaries. And so the Carolinas did the exact same. And so these other states were going, hey, they're considering that that state be formed in their state, and it can't be done without their consent. And they said, hold on here. We don't want to, do that and consider such as Kentucky being a part of Virginia. And so they didn't require a two-thirds. And I, if I remember correctly, Kentucky was conceded as same as Tennessee. And I think same thing with Vermont. It was those states were conceded that weren't necessary for the state legislatures to grant them. In other words, I don't believe that you went to New Hampshire, Virginia, and North Carolina in the creation of the first three states that joined the Union. They were admitted already because they were territories that were branches off of these, but they were prepared already by these states. So anyway, Mr. Sherman was against, he thought, unnecessary. The Union cannot dismember a state without its consent. Mr. Langlin thought there was great weight in the argument of what Mr. Martin was saying, and that the proposition substituted by Mr. Governor Morris would excite a dangerous opposition to the plan. Mr. Governor Morris thought, on the contrary, that the small states would be pleased with the regulation as it holds up the idea of dismembering large states. Mr. Butler, if new states were to be erected without the consent of the dismembering states, nothing but confusion would ensue. And that's correct. I mean, that only makes sense. Whenever taxes should press on the people, demagogues would set up their schemes of new states. Dr. Johnson agreed in general with the idea of Mr. Sherman, but was afraid that the clause stood. Okay, so we just ran out of time for today. We will wrap this up, and I, as I'm looking forward, we don't have much more on the notes, so we will end this either Monday or Tuesday next week, and then we'll dive into the ratification debates. We might take a little breather, but we will do that as we're moving forward for this year in trying to give you all of the content necessary. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.